Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Christopher Patterson. I am a doctoral candidate in the Department of English at the University of Washington, and I am the host of this podcast, New Books in Asian American Studies. Today we are joined by Dr. Aaron Kuei Ning, who is an associate professor at the Department of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Today we will discuss Dr. Ning's book, Ingratitude, The Debt-Bound Daughter in Asian American Literature, which was published by New York University Press in 2001, and in 2013 won the Literary Studies Book Award from the Association for Asian American Studies. Ingratitude investigates the figure of the daughter in Asian American literature, which has lately been dismissed as a figure that downplays political and historical conflict and instead fulfills the model minority achievement. Ning responds to this view by seeing the immigrant family as a form of capitalist enterprise, and thus the Asian American daughter as a locus of conflicting power. Through literary analyses of texts by Jade Snow Wong, Maxine Hunt Kingston, Evelyn Lau, and others, Ning explores the figure of the Asian American daughter as a person born in debt, whose obligation to the parents is always designated to fail, and whose rebellion comes in the form of sexual freedom and through the act of writing itself. Aaron, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin the interview by describing the intellectual trajectory that brought you to write the book Ingratitude.
Sure. The book came out of a graduate seminar taught by Julia Bader at Berkeley. She's retired now, I believe. That got me thinking about family spaces along these lines. It was the course was called The Marital Gothic. And we read Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper, Kate Chopin's The Awakening, also a handful of Gothic romances. I think this is a long time ago, but set in dark castles with brooding masters and young heroines. And that probably seems an odd place to start this book, but it also explains why there are these periodic references to Gothic romances in Ingratitude. And these probably seem completely out of place to anyone else. At least I felt that they might as I was writing the book. But they were unavoidable to me because I couldn't write my book without them because they were part of its genesis.
Oh, interesting. So how do you feel the Gothic particularly brought you to think about the family and the Asian American daughter?
Well, what struck me and what stayed with me from that course was this phenomenological sense of dis-ease, of suffocation, of dying that these women were experiencing, despite the fact that surrounding them were spaces of material comfort, seemingly loving husbands or children, no apparent violence. So what were these women dying of, and why couldn't they tell us? And I recognize that feeling as we went through the course, that going crazy in part because what pains you doesn't seem real to anyone else. And if you try to explain it, it sounds like nothing. So my book became this extended effort to explain what seems so normal in a lot of Asian immigrant families that it may sound like nothing to speak of.
Mm. You use that keyword, immaterial suffering, quite a lot in the book, especially in your first chapter, to kind of get at the, I guess, past this kind of stereotype of whining. I think you also attend to that, too. I think that's a very interesting place to start off with. But first of all, why do you start with the Asian American daughter? What concerned you with that figure in particular? If you're reading Gothic novels, there's all sorts of different family members that kind of appear. So why the daughter, and how does you think your own experience informed that project?
I wish I could say that the work came out of some noble, purely academic interest. But why the Asian American daughter is basically, because I am one, and I felt that Asian American scholarship had come to this consensus about what intergenerational conflict meant that was silencing and also wrong.
What do you feel that that consensus was, particularly on the Asian American daughter?
Well, that these narratives that I select for here, are the kinds of things that would get dismissed out of hand as being, you know, just another commercial venture by a sellout daughter making her family and culture look bad with no real redeeming political or critical qualities.
Mm. So part of your project seems to be then to bring politics or the kind of larger social structure under examination through this figure?
Right, right. To recontextualize, I guess, these narratives in political ways and give them back an ideological analysis that saw them with new value. As far as how my experience informed this project, it was difficult.
Hmm.
I spent a lot of time and energy agonizing on how not to speak autobiographically.
Mm.
And this project was thoroughly autobiographical. So, you know, how not to expose or reveal things about my family, despite the fact that our relationships informed every word I put down on these pages. But, you know, as I said, I didn't want to write another autobiography that would just be pigeonholed and dismissed. So I kept the academic language and methodology firmly in place at all times as a kind of screen or as an enabling mechanism.
Mm.
And then I also dropped these little hints, maybe glimpses, I guess, of where the book came from emotionally, because I wanted it to be recognizable to people, to call to readers who might know the same feeling, even if they're not academics.
Hmm. By the term Asian American daughter, you also seem most concerned with daughters of immigrants, particularly daughters of immigrants who came post-1965 or who were born after 1965. So what about, why this historical period particularly, why this context?
Well, I think why those daughters, or why those kids anyway, has to do with why those parents.
Mm.
So immigrants who came post-1965 also came post-civil rights era and at or after the consolidation of Asian Americans into this discourse of the model minority. So it's like being born as an American into the waiting arms of that role, or as we see in Nadia Kim or Nilou's work, having been groomed for it well before your arrival. So these post-1965 families are arguably particularly prone to buying in with relatively little friction to this neoliberal role of producing good little capitalist workers, successful and profitable children.
Hmm. You also seem to be wrestling with the model minority myth, which also came into popularity, as we know, post-1960s. How do you feel this myth affects the Asian American families that you're talking about, or the novels that you're talking about?
How do they affect the families? Well, in terms of encouraging a positioning of the families as what I call cottage industries for the production of said model minority workers, because the pathway seems clear. The pathway seems, in fact, you know, very defined, right? That study hard, get certain grades, take certain subjects, get certain degrees in college, that the opportunities are laid out. And so I think it because the paradigm was so welcoming of Asian Americans, so it kind of expectant of them in some ways, that it became more of a self-fulfilling prophecy for these families.
Mm. So part of this seems to be internalizing the model minority myth, or at least the parents internalizing that myth.
Right. Right. And encouraging the kids too. And in many cases, I think that internalization on the kids' part has been very successful. Mm. I just happen to focus on instances where it's not so much.
Yeah, speaking of that internalization, I was reading an article in the Huffington Post where you responded to the Korean writer Wesley Yang about his views growing up Asian American. And I think this was in 2001, I believe, and during the whole kind of Tiger Mother, you know, discourse becoming very popular. But it leads me to wonder, does the because you respond to Yang particularly in his views of Asian American sons, and I'm just curious how the family or the cottage industry, as you call it, raises sons differently than daughters. Like, why? I guess you focus on daughters partially because you were one, but how do you feel that is different?
I get this question a lot, so I appreciate being able to clarify that. In the first three, actually, of my four chapters, I don't much differentiate between sons and daughters, really. In building my arguments about filial debt and threats of disownment, I switch back and forth between second-generation narratives by men and women, even though it's the women's narratives that anchor each chapter. And then in the third chapter, about funneling children into lucrative careers by fetishizing, you know, math and devaluing the arts, I talk about how those expectations were initially only for sons because professional careers weren't an option for large numbers of women in the States, Asian or otherwise, until the late 80s. Late 70s, I guess, early 80s. So I'd say 3/4 of my argument is gender neutral.
And then the last fourth about sexuality, they particularly seems particularly more relevant to Asian American women. Is that correct?
Yes. So in the fourth chapter, I focus on gender-specific restrictions around controlling girls' sexuality because these kinds of restrictions allow for tighter control over a girl's time and space. And, you know, there's an argument that comes out of that, but I think on an emotional level, what I was trying to suss out is that being called a whore by one's family decimates at a level that, you know, even being called shiftless or worthless or ungrateful don't. So, you know, I guess I'd nutshell that by saying that it's a logical extension of a system of power that trains the subject to police herself and then makes her own destruction part of the equation, part of the price and means of revenge and escape.
I found that section fascinating, actually, because coupled with your response to Wesley Yang, too, because it seems to speak to this idea that's kind of permeated throughout Asian American studies as well, that Asian American males in their modes of resistance, we read it as immediately politicized, right? That they've been emasculated, right? Kind of like held up in geek culture. That, you know, that their absence of sexuality for many scholars speaks immediately to a kind of political social formation. Whereas when Asian American daughters or sisters, you know, are called whores, that doesn't immediately, you know, read as political. So I think that was a very interesting part of the both of your response and your last chapter, your fourth chapter, where you can kind of identify how that is immediately political or how the ways that we read it as unpolitical speak to our own kind of separate spheres, you know, the idea of separate spheres that kind of continues on. I mean, those are just my thoughts on it. But I was also curious about the model of the Asian American daughter, how I think in your introduction you compare her to other minorities, especially Jewish daughters before 1965 or before the 1980s, how this can help us read other immigrant groups, other minorities historically. Can you speak to that?
Well, I hesitate to... I hesitate to generalize too much here because I fear grossly overextending my data set. I haven't researched a great deal about Jewish or other immigrant communities. And so the book doesn't study any other non-Asian narratives in detail. I do cite, you know, a very few works or studies that compare Asian and other communities. And I do that in limited fashion just to make the point that the discourse or technologies of child rearing that, you know, I'm pointing out in model minority parenting, you know, whether it be debt or guilt or even emphasis on education, they're not exclusive or proprietary to Asian American families. I think if we look around, that they've shown up elsewhere historically when the social and racial climate met welcoming economic pathways and made them adaptive. But, you know, to be clear or careful anyway, tracing those actual parallels between the communities is not the task that I set for this book.
The figure of the Asian American daughter also in this book seems particularly centered on Chinese American daughters. Of the seven novels that you read, all but one are written by a Chinese American woman, I believe. So even though throughout the book you're kind of arguing against this stereotype of, you know, that Chinese daughters or Chinese men or Asian American men are special because of their Confucian values, you know, Confucian ethics and all that. Do you feel that there's something about either, you know, that background or Chinese cultural backgrounds or racisms associated particularly with Chinese or the political changes in China throughout the 20th century that also kind of inform the model minority stereotype or this project in general? This is also, I mean, just coming from, you know, the post-1965 is also kind of post or like right during the Cultural Revolution and all that. And you have, you know, Maoism taking over and people kind of retreating from it. You know, people from Taiwan also coming to the U.S. So as you kind of said before, the daughters also speak to the parents, right? What type of parents are coming? So how do you feel that kind of China itself is represented in the project?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate that you're not asking whether model minority parenting is just the same as Confucianism specifically.
Oh, no, yeah.
So I really appreciate that. But I acknowledge that because of the selection of text, there's this, inevitably this feeling that really what I'm writing about are Chinese American daughters. And that was both frustrating and difficult in the writing process because what I was gleaning from these texts, I didn't feel to be specifically Chinese American. I mean, for one thing, you know, being Vietnamese, that's certainly not how the narratives make sense to me or read to me as a function of Chinese national political character or history. But you know, while I did draw as much as I could from a smattering of, I think there's some Japanese American, some South Asian writings for the book, certainly the marquee texts are almost all Chinese American. And when I started writing it, well, I think if I started it 5 or 10 years later, I honestly think that the Chinese question would have been much more negligible or maybe non-existent just by virtue of the greater diversity ethnically in intergenerational conflict narratives that I've been able to incorporate. And I certainly think that that would have been the case now. So, you know, I guess in answer to your question about whether, you know, I would trace these patterns that I'm looking at to a specific national history, I don't. Maybe it's because I refuse to. But
Yeah, it kind of speaks to your overall narrative that, you know, the internalization of this kind of stereotype, you know, for most Americans, I guess I would say white Americans, right? Asian Americans are just kind of Asian, right? They're not necessarily Chinese, Japanese, or Korean. So I think your book speaks to that well. Let's get right into the meat of the book with your first chapter. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. Can I just add one little thing more to that?
Just please, yeah.
I guess, you know, if anything, as I'm thinking about your question now, that resistance to tracing it back to a specific Chinese American cultural or national history. Mm-hmm. That has something to do with my thinking of this book as very much a second generation Asian American mm-hmm. work. And, you know, I clearly show, I think, the roots of Asian American identity formation and the social movement here from the 60s, right, specifically, mm-hmm. where, you know, I don't think of my work as transnational. I don't think of my work as, you know, really even diasporic. I think of it as trying to figure out this Asian American identity, which is a domestic product. Right, mm-hmm. is a function of our from all our various places and all our various histories having arrived here and being received by a single set of racial discourses. And I mean, that's what fascinates me, really, is that in so many ways, all of the, you know, the religious differences, language differences, even, you know, differences in decade of immigration or, you know, terms of immigration, class background, all of that can get erased by our internalization and investment in the model minority identity and reproducing it. Hmm. So I think that is so powerful. That is really what I wanted to focus on, and therefore things like the specificity of, you know, a particular, the Cultural Revolution, for example, was not key to me, except in the way that it might be used discursively in the family. Mm-hmm. And other things like that then could be used discursively in the family in interchangeable ways in different families and different ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah, just catching on to what you said about that, you feel like this, the representation of this type of daughter also appears in South Asian texts. And your other text that I didn't mention is from a South Asian American writer. Mm-hmm. But being a Filipino American myself, I keep thinking of that book, Her Wild American Self, by Evelina mm-hmm. Galang. And I think there's a completely different representation of, you know, the Filipina American in that text that, you know, doesn't seem, I mean, she, you know, clearly oppressed with this kind of, with sexual norms, but mm-hmm. not quite to the tier, I would say, of that you get in the Chinese American and Japanese American texts. Because I just noticed you didn't say Southeast Asian, like, you know, Laotian, Cambodian, Filipino. Like, do you feel like there's a different mode there, or that the model minority myth is less in evidence there?
You know, I think that, say, Vietnamese and Filipino writing that I've seen, both on the amateur level and in publication, that there's more, that there's maybe even remarkable similarity there. Mm. Not across all of it, of course, but yeah, that I can see the narrative being replicated there, in ways that, well, I just don't know. I guess I haven't seen enough of Khmer or Hmong literature to say so. I don't, again, I'm wary of venturing there. But while I, excuse me, haven't referenced, and I don't reference, I suppose, even in speaking of the book, a lot of Southeast Asian or, you know, Pacific Islander literature, I would say, you know, the shoe fits, wear it. And that the shoe fits more often than we would expect, I think, given the extensive differences between these groups.
I was thinking that, too, because there's another novel I kept thinking of throughout reading your text, Monkey Bridge, right? which is, I think, the very first Vietnamese-American novel. It definitely seems like one of the first. I think it's published in the late 90s, but much of it seems like a response to model minority myths, as opposed to, you know, and partially because it's coming at such a later time, and many of the, you know, the Southeast Asian narratives are coming at a much later time, so maybe they're responding, they have time to respond to that myth more than, you know, texts published in the 70s, 60s, and 80s.
Right, right. I think that makes sense, that these later texts have also, in a sense, moved on, that they're more interested in later or different kinds of iterations of immigrant narrative, or, you know, a Jesse Aves American Life, and not necessarily in rehearsing the intergenerational conflict struggle in classic ways again, that maybe, you know, on a commercial level, the relationship is bored. So I don't know that we'll ever get the same kind of representation of these narratives from Southeast Asian writers as we have from, you know, Chinese American writers. But that's not to say that it's not happening in families. That's why I think, you know, if we look, say, at the blogosphere or at other forms of narrative that are not dependent on the publishing industry, that we may find a lot more material along these lines to work with. But I mean, this is one of those moments as I was working on this book where I felt like, Jesus, if I could just do some field work. And, you know, I just was stuck with whatever publishers decided to give me.
Let's start with your first chapter, the chapter on Jade Snow Wong's book, Fifth Chinese Daughter. And I have to admit, when I first read this book, probably like 10 years ago, I was one of those people who just, you know, couldn't help but roll my eyes at, you know, it depicted, I don't know, it just seemed so model minority to me when I was reading it for the first time. Yeah. But your chapter really reveals, you know, this relationship of debt bondage, as you put it, and as you also put it, an economy of necessity. Can you take us through how you do that, or any either of those key terms, necessity or debt bondage, how the daughter herself is in that role?
I will try, or I will sum up. I'll start with the term necessity, which of course isn't mine. I get it from Sally Wong to talk about the kind of rhetoric that's used in the family to regulate children's uses of time and resources. So whatever the family, or so whatever the parent, I guess, demands is deemed necessary to the family's well-being and survival, while whatever is disallowed or disapproved is deemed extravagance. But that's as tautological as it sounds, these definitions. And one of the upshots of that is that there's really no limits to the parental jurisdiction of necessity. Basically, everything the child is becomes subject to being commandeered for the family's good. And that's in part because everything the child is, he or she owes to the family, you know, at bottom for having been born. And, well, this is one of my first beefs with filial debt, that it's not something that you're supposed to be able to repay. You're just supposed to work at it or at working it off forever. I compare the logic of filial debt to peonage, or as you mentioned, debt bondage. So, you know, this is where kind of arrangement where an employer advances the cost of passage to a migrant worker and owns that worker's labor until that sum, you know, that advanced sum is paid off. Now, basically, there's this ruse, you know, of a finite debt that can be settled with hard work, frugal living, playing by the rules. But the exploitative version of the system, and, you know, historically speaking, it's often been exploitative, is that the employer keeps tacking on the costs of room and board, the essentials of daily living, to this ever-growing tab. So the debt climbs more quickly than, you know, a worker's paltry wages can hope to eclipse. And so just by virtue of living, you owe more each day. Now, the reason I started thinking about Jade Snow Wong in these terms is because in her memoir, she is forever obsessively tallying how much she makes at various jobs and chores. And And meanwhile, she's also trying to minimize what she, you know, quote unquote, costs the family. You know, she just seems conscious of every bite of food or every article of clothing, because the power that her parents wield over her existence, right, increases with every debit.
Mm.
But Jade Snow doesn't realize there's no paying this off. That even if she succeeds wildly, any achievement she attains in her life only really goes to show how much more she owes her parents for the good life she now has. And of course, every failure means that she has squandered what she was given, so now she's deeper in the hole. So either way, right, win or lose, the debt has grown. But I think the most awful thing about necessity and debt as the foundations of family relationships is that everything the child is, good or bad, becomes tabulated by that single system of values, and that mm. system is monetary.
Mm.
So it sets the stage for later in life, where the value of what you can do for a living, say, is purely monetary. I mean, how can a career have any other meanings? How can it be legible by any other meanings in this system when your very life is just a series of debits and credits?
I think this speaks to really the kind of political contribution, I think, of the book, that the structure of the family, as you call it, is a kind of a capitalist enterprise. I think you use that phrase.
Yeah.
And are you claiming, in a sense, that this form, reproduces, I suppose, a neoliberal subjectivity in a way that it kind of trains, sons and daughters to think only in monetary terms, that of their own value as monetary?
Right. That everything is either a commodity or it becomes kind of incoherent, right? And yeah, that they become trained to cultivate their value along commodifiable lines. I would definitely agree.
Let's on that note, let's move to the second chapter of your book.
Sure.
You look at Maxine Hunt Kingston's novel, Woman Warrior. I don't know if you'd call it a memoir. I can leave that up to whoever.
stand.
Yeah, right. Whatever your political relations to her are. But you see her relationship with her parents in a unique way as one of sovereign power, and that the violence of their relationship seems to fall in the threat of always being abandoned by them. Like, this is kind of, I mean, this is getting even more to the heart of the family narrative, right? That there's this threat of being abandoned or disowned that probably wouldn't actually happen, but it's just kind of like there is a threat, you know, sometimes a veiled, sometimes a very explicit threat, you know. So I'm just curious how you see that happening in the novel. And in this chapter, you also bring out more of the immaterial suffering, how Kingston particularly kind of captures that immaterial suffering that allows us to see the daughter as a kind of politicized figure. Can you speak about your second chapter and how I mentioned a lot of things, sovereign power, wherever you want to start with that.
Well, actually, before I dive into any of that, do you mind if I make a quick tangent?
Oh, go ahead.
I met up with Maxine Hunt Kingston a few weeks ago when she was in town in Santa Barbara doing a reading. And she shared with me the best story about Jade Snow Wong. So it turns out that the Wong family had some major longevity. And her mother lived till she was past 100.
Wow.
So when Jade Snow was like 85 years old, her mother was still asking her if she was going to find a real job. it's just perfect. I wish I'd known that somehow writing the book. The Kingston chapter, yes, that's where I first bring up disownment.
Mm.
What I say about disownment there is how the threat of that, of being kicked out of the family for not achieving obedience, is, as you say, always there in the background. And interestingly, it's ready to be activated for the most trivial of reasons. Mm. So this, for me, was trying to explain the scale of anger or backlash that Maxine or others of my narrators would describe receiving from their parents for even the most minor infractions, even unpredictably minor infractions, like coming home a few minutes late, even though you called, or wearing the wrong shoes. Mm. These transgressions would be received as if you just stab the family in the gut. And that's the thing. That's the disproportionate quality of that response tells you that the basis of this relationship is that of banishment. Mm. So, you know, in the first chapter, I was trying to work through something appalling. what was appalling about debt and necessity and the commodification, basically, of all, you know, value in the child. And then the second horror for me here is being conditioned as a child to your position in the family as provisional and, you know, kind of hair trigger provisional, that is liable to being revoked for any reason subject to the sovereign's sole discretion. Mm. So if this is the ever-present power play, right, you know, the always ultimatum that you behave or be disowned, then no wonder there are no graduated levels of anger pegged to varying severities of discretion. If you fucked up, then the whole weight of the ultimatum comes down on you, because there is no such thing as disownment that can be doled out in fractions. Right?
It seems like a very, I like that you mentioned sovereign power, because it helps us imagine, you know, this idea that you could any time be executed or something, you know, in a sense, like a type of social death. Because we usually imagine it, you know, as parents saying, like, this is for your own good, you know, this is for your own health that I'm doing this. Right. I mean, in the novel, it seems like it's more, it is like, as you describe, it's more kind of like these just bare threats of, like, you know, you're going to embarrass us or your ancestors or something like that, more than we would expect, which is, you know, your own health and your own body relies on you, you know, regulating yourself in certain ways.
Right. Yeah, as you say, you know, sometimes bare and sometimes veiled, but always kind of there. And so what I wanted to try to map out, I guess, is how that everlasting underlying threat would play out in a child's psyche, to know that her status as a daughter could be put on the chopping block at any time, right? So even if she's never actually disowned, as you said, right? Mm. She just lives the constant threat, then what does that do to her?
Mm. Yeah, do you have any thoughts on what that does to her particularly? Like part of this chapter also meditates on how do you capture this kind of immaterial suffering when, you know, your parents especially, or parents in general, have been downplaying it, you know, all your life. You know, so how does that kind of manifest, you think, later in life, this idea that you've just been whining and there's no real, you know, material proof of your suffering?
Right. Well, your first question about what it does to what it does to the daughter, I think that I addressed maybe in a later chapter more so than this one. But yes, in this chapter, the other thing that it does is that I'm trying to explain the challenges of expressing pain in ways that will be validated if your pain is not visible on the body or empirically verifiable somehow, right? Yeah, to your readership, to anyone, much less to your parents. So, Anne Chang talks about this problem racially in terms of racial grievance, right, which you can sue for and even put a dollar amount on, right, versus racial grief, which, yeah, at best you're supposed to just get over. And that's if anyone believes that you suffered a loss at all. So I talk about both Ann Chiang's work, actually, and Kingston as having to find some very circuitous ways to express what subjection feels like for Asian Americans, you know, especially second generation Asian Americans, when what it looks like is, yes, that you're whining in the lap of luxury. So key in this argument for both, I think, this is a key moment for both Chiang and for me, is the illness that Maxine describes having, where she spent those 18 months in bed with no pain, no symptoms, but didn't have to go to school, right? And that's a pretty dubious oppression when you have no observable ailments and you seem to be getting special treatment. Mm. So I don't know if maybe this point isn't too much in the weeds to explain well here, but in this chapter, I try to argue that both Chiang and Kingston resort to comparing or borrowing from Black or immigrant forms, you know, like the no-name woman or the mother's experiences, to express Asian American and second generation experience. But, you know, does it work? You know, I don't know. I think what I think you that there's that it does a lot of expressive work, this comparison, this borrowing, and yet it remains flawed, and you know, in understandable ways. For one thing, I think what we see in some of the later texts that I talk about is a different kind of tactic for expressing this kind of pain, which you might call somaticizing strategies. Mm. So various tactics for marking this kind of invisible psychic pain onto the body where it can be treated or at least seen, but ends up, of course, being self-destructive as well.
Mm. Is this so in your third chapter, you talk about Evelyn Lau's book, Runaway, and Catherine Leo's Oriental Girls Desire Romance. So part of your point, I think, in these texts is that they have this kind of, you know, as you called it, psychosomatic, but also masochistic response to parental control. Can you, let's talk about that for a moment. Why masochism and why psychosomaticism?
Well, you know, I don't want to imply that this is literally psychosomatic, but I want to definitely make a kind of analogy there that they're enacting pain on their bodies in this way that makes it more legible. Mm. So, okay, so why masochistic? Well, maybe I'll start with
because both of these texts seem to be about very, like, they're going out into the world, you know, they seem very, like, they're resisting their parents, but, you know, kind of to the detriment of their own bodies, you know, whether they're, and part of their, then, reconciliation, I guess, is to write about their experiences, which you also read as a type of, you know, response to parental control and a masochistic one at that. Like, I guess I'm just curious why... you know, why they seek to harm their own bodies in these texts, at least, and how writing can be a kind of response. Like, you'd think successful writing, right, would be a good way to make a living and, you know, would really impress the parents. But here it seems to be more of an act of rebellion, yeah?
Right, yeah. So, yes, what's interesting to me about both of these figures, the Lau and the Lu figures, is that, as you say, they both come off, initially anyway, as very rebellious, resistant daughters. Mm. And they seem to be, you know, hell-bent on breaking all the rules and getting out of the house and all of that. But the more I looked at it, the more I felt like the kinds of rebellion that they were choosing were also very self-punishing. Mm. And... self-punishing in terms of, yes, their own body. So they put themselves at risk in frightening ways, risk of disease, risk of injury, risk of death. So Evelyn Lau, of course, is the memoir of a 14-year-old girl who runs away from home. And so she lives on the streets for a number of years, 2 years. At least that's the length of time that this diary that I look at covers. And in that time, you know, she nearly starves. She gets, you know, attacked. She, you know, nearly freezes on the street. So, yes, this kind of risk to self, which she chooses partly because of how effective it is in this indirect way, this implicit way of showing that, you know, she would rather undergo that than live at home. Right. And so it conveys something very powerfully. At the same time, who is suffering for her choice? Well, first and most directly, her. And I think that model extends to other life decisions. And in this kind of, you know, wry and depressing way, I include writing careers, include, and, you know, even academic writing careers, I devoted to literature as these forms of rebellion that are also self-punishing, because some of the things that in this case you're punishing maybe not your body, but you're punishing your wallet, and you're punishing your ability to you know, quote unquote, succeed in the model minority forms. But of course, those are, you know, materially very rewarding. And so, what is it to turn away from the opportunities of those clear pathways and decide instead to be poor, right? There's that I talk about in terms of the writing, and then also that both of these writers, also Lau and Liu, express how painful writing itself can be. That they do it in a way that is a bit like rending oneself open. And so if you look at each of these instances and what comes across, comes through across all of them is the pain that they inflict on themselves, then I wanted to understand why that pain was there, right? Why why wasn't resistance just a matter of, you know, kind of finding hedonistic pleasure? But it seemed to me that there was some kind of bargain being struck, right? Well, partly these particular modes of rebellion were, of course, conditioned by the terms of parental expectations and necessity itself, right? That what they ended up choosing were the things that they weren't clearly supposed to choose, because they're not lucrative. Writing, reading, etc., is the opposite of math and the STEM fields in their minds and in the family's minds, and also in the in the economic sphere. So
it's kind of like they're devaluing the value of money and monetary value. Like they're responding to that kind of neoliberal subjectivity, resisting it in a way.
So they're turning away from that. Absolutely. You know, they're declining it, but they decline it at their own expense.
It feels like, to me, like one of the things I really liked about this chapter was in the chapter before you talk about this immaterial suffering, and then you have like this very like, you know, easy to see, I guess, very recognizable type of suffering, you know, living on the streets, exposure to the cold, you know, just so many things that happen in these women's lives. And then the kind of, you know, punchline or the payoff is it's still better than the suffering I went through at home.
Right.
So it gives us a kind of a different comparison to their immaterial suffering that seems different from, like, as you were saying with, you know, Anne Chung, that comparing the Asian American experience to African Americans, it seems like this is a different kind of lens to see that suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, a different way of trying to express it.
So in your fourth chapter, you end the book with a meditation on female sexuality and the attempts to discipline sexual desire in the family. And you start out with a very, like, basic question, why rebellious girls have sex and why parents even care that they have sex. So look, can you just begin with that? What did you find out about that in these narratives?
First of all, I appreciate that you put it that way in terms of what I found out, as odd as that sounds, because once the book is done, you tend to talk about it in terms of what I argue and
yeah.
My position is, but that's really not the process. And it's mm-hmm. nice to be reminded, you know, that, that it was written with questions, you don't know the answers to, and that, anyway, it reminded me that I kept writing in this book until, you know, a sentence would knock the wind out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would stop. But, okay, so it's a deceptively simple question, right?
Mm, yeah.
Why rebellious girls have sex? Why parents care? And there's the part about why parents care is actually maybe a little boring to talk about.
It's boring, but it's quite it speaks to our assumptions, right? We always assume, of course, parents are going to care, but then to ask why, like, that's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, maybe if I can just kind of cut to the end of this, you know, what I ended up arguing is that, you know, we think that parents keep girls at home because they want to regulate their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
But what I ended up arguing is that, well, maybe parents regulate girls' sexuality so they can keep the girls at home.
Mm.
And if you contextualize this in what I argued in previous chapters about, you know, creating the very self-policing subject, somebody who comes to try to anticipate the wishes of power even before they're expressed, even if power hasn't yet even formulated that particular wish, right, that sexual control, especially with, you know, the narrative of it's being for your own good, for your own protection, mm. right? And the kind of harsh bodily threat that will come from elsewhere, but we are going to protect you from this by keeping you within these four walls. Right, oh, sorry, that was my phone. We can see those same mechanisms working, but when it comes to, you add the, you know, the regulation of female sexuality in, it seems to work, excuse me, to like this nth degree.
Mm.
And then in terms of why then rebellious girls have sex, again, you know, well, it's just kind of flipping the choices. But beyond that, I also think it's interesting because there is such an element of pleasure in it, mm-hmm. right? That it's easy to see that and then miss what I keep obsessing about, which is the equal element of pain and self-destruction and punishment in these sexual choices, many of which for the narrators that I talk about in this chapter are terrible sexual choices, right? Again, they're not going out there, at least at this stage in their, you know, young, early rebellions and finding healthy relationships to replace their familial ones. Mm. No, they what they seem to court is more damage, right? Mm. But again, it's this kind of weird devil's bargain that the pain is somehow punishing them, but they're buying their way out of paying for, you know, filial debt directly to the parents by just kind of enacting punishment on their own bodies, on their own relationships, on their own psyches.
And it seems like a very, particularly, like, as we were saying before, a reaction from the daughter as opposed to the sons. And I just wanted to know, by terrible decision, you don't mean just because they're promiscuous, but also because they're choosing to, like, be with people who don't respect them at all, who right. sometimes very violent, right?
Yeah, or strangers, right? Mm-hmm. And without taking care of themselves, mm-hmm. right? That there's in these last two chapters, I was really trying to describe this carelessness with the self, mm-hmm. right? That, well, I mean, if your life isn't yours to begin with, then would you care if you lose it, I suppose, right? But then, on the other hand, the way to demonstrate that it is yours is to destroy it. Like, nobody can destroy it like mm-hmm. I can, right? So, it's the ambiguousness, the ambivalence of these acts, that they're both seeking, you know, self-preservation, and they're seeking their own destruction, and they seem to only know how to find one through the other. That I'm trying to talk through in the last two paragraphs or chapters.
So to kind of end on a bit of a happier note, I guess, like, after all this talk of immaterial suffering, I'm sure you've gotten this question from readers at the end, you know, like, what are we, I don't know, like, as children of the second generation, you know, the third generation, I guess you could say, you know, what do, I almost want to say, where's the hope, but that sounds like too hopeful in a way. But, you know, what are we to do, I guess, you know, how do you see this style of this, you know, capitalist enterprise, this family as a capitalist enterprise being reproduced now? Do you feel like, you know, as we were kind of saying, that literature, it seems, has either gotten fed up with or has, you know, overproduced this kind of narrative? Where do you see things going after the kind of second generation?
You know, I always feel like when people ask this, I should apologize for ending the book.
No, not at all.
It's a terrible place. And it's true. I knew as I ended it, right, that what I'd done here was just to provide a diagnostic. And then as a diagnostic, it really just tells you, oh, you have cancer, I'm sorry. But it doesn't really go into, okay, and here's what we're going to do next at all. But, you know, the way that I framed the academic work, I really feel like I can't. Right. If I start talking about, oh, and here's hope, and here's how you get out of it, then it's almost like I'm writing a self-help book suddenly in the last chapter. And so I didn't. You know, I feel that in some ways, you know, while it sounds bleak, that the reason I wrote the book was to not only diagnose the dynamics here, mm-hmm. but also to point out the shortcomings of maybe some of our existing strategies for coping. Mm. Right? And so, you know, my own hope, and honestly, writing this helps me a great deal was that being able to see the double-edgedness of things and, you know, the ways in which we were choosing to self-punish and self-destroy even as we were hoping to resist, right, would enable different choices that I didn't then proceed to prescribe or describe, but that, you know, I hope to have made more possible or more easily visible from here.
Okay, well, on that note, are you working on any new research now? Or what are the kind of next steps after this?
Well, I am working on taking some of these old topics and putting in a new direction. So, you know, when I talk about ingratitude, I often get pushback from social scientists asking me where I get my data. And I can say until I'm blue in the face that what I'm trying to get at in this book were questions of discourse and questions mm-hmm. of subjectivity, which seemed to me to be particularly well-suited for literature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not so much the province of self-report essays or surveys, sorry. You know, but at the end of the day, this work and even those explanations, they don't win me many social scientist fans. So the next project is about trying to bridge that gap, that epistemological breach, you know, really between what social scientific and humanistic methodologies believe that we can know about the same topic and how we can validly come to know it. So the working title for my next project is Interdisciplinary Conflict, literary and psychological studies on the Asian American immigrant family. So I'll be taking up questions of parenting and intergenerational conflict again, but I'm hoping to compare literary and research psychology approaches to them. So
that sounds fascinating. Now it's also the family of Asian American studies. No,
it's the subject. Exactly. And I don't have anything to show. So, it's I think it's going to be exciting. It's also a little daunting, as you can mm-hmm. imagine.
Well, I want to thank you, Erin, for being on the show today. I think I learned a lot, and if your goal was to represent immaterial suffering in ways, I definitely felt that. I feel much differently about these novels than I did when I'm first reading them. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Chris. It means a lot to me.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you once again for listening to my interview with Dr. Erin Kuei Ning on her book, Ingratitude. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to hear another interview with an author about the subject of politicizing women in the home, domestic work, and daughters, I highly suggest the interview with Emily Machar on her book, Homeward Bound, Why Women Are Embracing the New Domesticity. This podcast can be found on the New Books in American Studies website or on iTunes. Just search for New Books in American Studies. I highly suggest this podcast. Thank you again for listening.